Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And, oh, I'm delighted to have Francis Boyle back again this morning. And for listeners who don't follow him as you should, let me just explain briefly. Francis is an international law and human rights expert. He's a professor of law at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, downstate from me. And he lectures widely. He writes extensively. He's authored many, many books. His latest one is titled Tackling America's Toughest Questions, Alternative Media Interviews, and at least one in the mainstream media. We'll mention that a little bit in the program. The book documents critiques and refutes all of the atrocities of the Bush administration has inflicted upon international law and human rights, the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights, throughout Bush's entire tenure, the same agenda, so far at least, continued under Barack Obama. Francis, welcome back to the program.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much for having me on, and my best to your listening audience.
Oh, I'm delighted. Whenever you come on, it will be a riveting hour, to say the least. You sent me a couple of emails this morning. Maybe we can review that very quickly. At first, I didn't look at the dates and didn't realize that Elena Kagan is our new Solicitor General. And then I thought, this email was dated in February. And then I discovered that, I guess, around mid-March, she became our new Solicitor General, meaning she is the one who represents the country arguing before the Supreme Court. And she is not necessarily the best one to be doing it. She hired a war criminal as a professor at Harvard Law School when she was dean. Oh, dear. You're an alumnus of Harvard Law. I think you had some different sort of people there, Francis, than the sort of folks there now that you say, and I remember you said it in the past, you wrote an article in the past about it, don't send your kids to Harvard Law School.
Right. Well, I sent it along because as we have been seeing now with the Obama administration's in court, Kagan not only argues cases in the Supreme Court, but also the U.S. Courts of Appeal, and is pretty much in charge of developing the Obama litigation strategy in the United States federal court. And what we have seen with the Obama administration so far now into 100 days is a refusal to abandon the reprehensible positions the Bush administration has taken in court and adopt new positions. And instead, under the direction of Kagan, has ratified and condoned almost across the board in court all of the briefs and arguments that the Bush administration has made so far. Even the Ninth Circuit, in a recent hearing on state secrets, was simply amazed and surprised that there was no change between the Bush and Obama positions in court. So, you know, public rhetoric is one thing. What they're actually doing in court is continuing the Bush policies. And I pointed out that is thoroughly predictable under Kagan, who is really a one of these closet neocons in
Francis,
the Obama administration.
Let me interrupt. We need to break away for a commercial. We'll come right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Francis Boyle. Francis, I guess I'm old enough to have lived through enough bad administrations, all of the bad policy that came out of them, And one of the quotes that I like to use every now and then goes back to the beginning of the Republic and our first Supreme Court Justice, John Jay. And he said, the country ought to be run by the people who own it. And our second president said virtually the same thing. And that was basically the way they designed things from the beginning. As far as Obama goes, I followed him throughout the campaign. I never for a moment was under any illusion that whatever he might say to the contrary, that he would bring an administration. There really was a dramatic change from the one that would be leaving, hopefully. Couldn't be sure at the time. There's always the overt coup d'etat in the background. You never can tell. But I guess it didn't really matter because the names may have changed, but the policies stay the same. So I call Obama George Bush's third term. And you see it in your writing, in your comments now. And we can get into the book because you sure cover a lot of stuff. It's just continuing on without missing a beat.
Well, that's correct. And Kagan, actually the Solicitor General now, and who is quarterbacking all the Obama strategies in court, she's a crony of Larry Summers, whom I'm sure you've already discussed.
Indeed.
He's a crook to begin with. And another closet neocon. Now in charge of orchestrating the Obama economic policies there at the White House. So it's not a good sign at all. You are right. I didn't vote for Obama because it just seemed to me, once he had won the nomination, the Democratic nomination, of course, he then proceeded to hire on the entire Democratic establishment and veered far to the right, and everything has been pretty much predictable since then. We've seen a lot of rhetoric and smoke and mirrors, but so far the policies have been pretty much the same as they were under Bush Jr.
Oh, indeed, Francis. I wrote three articles covering every single one of his key appointees that were known at the time. I didn't know about Kagan at the time. Oh, there were a couple that hadn't been appointed yet. There were names that were floated around. I mentioned a few of them. But I went through them all from the economic to security, political, Eric Holder as attorney general. My conclusion was, it amounted to a rogues gallery of appointees, exactly the wrong kind of people to be representing the interests of the people of the country and exactly the right kind of people to be representing the power structure of the country, which is exactly the way it went on under George Bush. New faces, same policy. And it's pretty outrageous. Larry Summers, oh, my goodness. The combination, the triumvirate of Larry Summers, Ben Bernanke, and Timothy Geithner, oh, my God. I mean, they're co-in charge of looting the national wealth for the people who committed the most massive fraud in world history. And instead of being punished, Francis, they're rewarded with the latest number I saw on Bloomberg was $12.8 trillion.
Right. It's we're in dire straits. What can I say? I don't know. It is obviously disappointing. I had expected some minimal change, but it doesn't look like the American people are going to get it, even though we did vote for it in the last election, and Iraq is still continuing. Now Petraeus and the others are saying, well, these so-called deadlines are very flexible, and we might be staying in Iraq for a while. The massive escalation into Afghanistan, which, yeah, I think even informed commentators would say is a sinkhole. We're facing a type of Vietnam War situation there. And nothing has really changed. And with respect to Afghanistan and Pakistan, in the Obama administration, it's gotten worse. And the looting is simply astounding. And, you know, it's really Summers pulling the strings here. We know him from the Clinton administration, the infamous World Bank memorandum saying that the Third World is underpolluted, and therefore we need to figure out ways to move pollution from the Western developed capitalist world to the third world. Then president at Harvard, that women are dumber than men in math and sciences. Harvard's program that defrauded the United States federal government with respect to other things they were doing in Russia. That took place under Summers' watch. Summers made millions of dollars on the board of a hedge fund, direct conflict of interest, which under the Obama guidelines, he should have disqualified Summers from holding any office at all. Meanwhile, they disqualify the head of Human Rights Watch under these conflict of interest guidelines from running as Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights. So I think we understand what the priorities of this administration are, which it certainly is not human rights. It does not appear to be the United States Constitution in court. And that is unfortunate because Obama was supposed to be a law professor teaching part-time there at the University of Chicago Law School in Chicago. Although we've discussed it before, I'm an alumnus up there. And that law school and that university, you know, is completely right-wing, racist, bigoted, reactionary, warmongering, totalitarian. And many of his advisors that he's drawn into the administration, like Goolsbee, his economic advisors and others, have come from the University of Chicago. Kagan taught there, where I guess she met Obama on the faculty. So, you know, the list of these people go on.
From the war criminals at the Harvard Law School to Chicago School Economics, Francis, my goodness gracious. It gets my blood to the boiling temperature. And I didn't go to the Harvard Law School. I went to the college, so we're both alumni of the same place. And it almost embarrasses me to admit it. I mean, imagine that. And I went, I think I've got a few years on you, a little bit older. I went there, and I like to mention this to show just one example of how a poor kid could, first of all, be lucky enough to get to be admitted to Harvard College in 1952. I still have my letter of acceptance. It's a bit yellow now. But I still remember the day it arrived, and I couldn't bear to open the envelope expecting the worst. But I had to do it finally, and I needed to read it about five times. It wasn't very long before I realized they really were going to let me in. But my freshman year in 1952, I think I mentioned this yesterday, a full year's tuition was $600. A full year's tuition. Now, if you live there, I lived at home my first 2 years. Then lived at school. So if you live there, let's say, with all expenses, aside from personal ones, double the $600. So for about $1,200, you could live there, room, board, school fees, tuition. Today it's about $50,000, meaning a poor kid like me, even at a higher level of income, family income, there's no way in the world that I could go there without some very substantial help. And it was really designed this way. The inflation that's built into the economy, plus the fact that tuitions go up faster than the official rate of inflation anyway. So the class divisions in the country have widened. The policies of the country just seem to get worse and worse and worse. The wars that never end. The economic looting that really began in high gear when Ronald Reagan came in. Gee, I've written a little bit about that. Alan Greenspan committed, in my judgment, Francis, a terrible crime on the American people before he became Fed chairman in 1987. He restructured the Social Security system as a way of looting it to make middle and lower income people pay the lion's share of it, and the rich only paid it up to a maximum income level, meaning I don't remember what it was in those days. It could have been 20,000, 30,000 maximum. So if you earn $1 million a year, you pay payroll tax on a minute portion of it and got off scot-free on the rest. But ordinary people paid on it all. And this was a way to transfer wealth to the rich. So he was rewarded for doing that and made Federal Reserve chairman, where he looted on a much grander scale. Oh, what can
you
say?
Well, again, what we're seeing with Obama is the Harvard Law School mafia and the University of Chicago mafia pretty much coming in and running the country. And I'm an alumnus of both institutions. What can I say? So I know how they operate and how they train their people to be completely ruthless, unprincipled individuals, caring only for themselves. And but they're very good at co-opting at these two institutions brain power from lower classes, as you correctly pointed out. That is, the people who run the government understand that intelligence is distributed across socioeconomic classes. And so what they try to do is to identify very bright, intelligent young people, even from, at least they used to, lower and middle classes, bring them to places like Harvard and Chicago, co-opt them into the power elite, and then turn that brain power against the common, ordinary, everyday American people, because they know they need brain power to run the country and to loot it for the interests of the power elite. I mean, Obama?
We need to break again, Francis. We'll come right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
International law expert, professor of law, University of Illinois, prolific author, and very definitely a man on the right side of the issues that listens to this program, certainly believe in, or they've never wasted time listening to me. Well, they don't waste their time listening to this program. You need to get away from primetime TV and spend more time with programs like this. This is not the only one. There are others. You just have to find them and listen to them. Good people saying the right things. Francis, when you were at Chicago, did you have any contact with Milton Friedman?
I refused to study with those people, just as a matter of principle, for the same reason that I refused to study with all pro-Vietnam War professors. It was well known Friedman was just ruthless, unprincipled, thoroughly Machiavellian. His market economics, market fundamentalism, certainly even at the time, struck me as the American equivalent of the Nazi philosophy of useless eaters. So I simply would not study with him, even though, he was right there. I saw him all the time, sure. But I just could not bring myself. I know Greg Palast did go to study with Friedman for the purpose, basically, of spying on him for the labor movement, the unions. And Greg was a little bit behind me, I guess, at Chicago. But he has written about this experience in one of his books, that he would, he would take the Friedman classes and then tell the unions exactly what Friedman was up to and what he was doing. I simply could not bring myself to study with the man or any of his acolytes up there. It was just too much for me, and it was the same attitude I had toward professors who were openly advocating the Vietnam War. For example, at Harvard, the PhD program I went through there in the government department had Sam Huntington, and I simply refused to study with Huntington as a matter of principle, because he was openly advocating and supporting the Vietnam War. I know a lot of my fellow students felt the exact same way, and yet if you look at it, Huntington recently died, and he's been adulated by the power elite, the political establishment. This Fareed Zakaria, his program now on CNN, he's he was a student of Huntington. Mearsheimer and Walt, their study on the Israel lobby. Mearsheimer teaches at the University of Chicago in the political science department. They devote their book to Sam Huntington. And the man was a totalitarian, warmonger, and indeed a diehard racist before he died. I mean, putting aside his book on Clash of Civilizations, which was appalling, before he died, he published an essay, which I did read. He later turned into a book, which I didn't waste my time reading, basically arguing against Latinos here in America because they were diluting and polluting the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant ethos of this country. It was just a total racist rant. But, you know, that's Huntington going back to, you know, his days at Harvard. As I understand it, his, you know, his PhD dissertation, I hadn't read, but I was told in the government department it was about United States Military Academy at West Point, and the basic argument was, wouldn't it be great if the entire United States of America were run by the, like, along the lines of the United States Military Academy at West Point? Let's just militarize the place.
Oh,
but,
my goodness.
You know, he died, and everyone that you can imagine was praising a racist warmonger who was that way, certainly when I was a student at Harvard and refused to have anything to do with him, just as I, you know, refused to have anything to do with Friedman. But Friedman's viewpoints were well known when I was there, and I was just repelled by him and his whole Chicago School of Economics. Naomi Klein, I think, in her book Shock Therapy, does an excellent job.
Oh, indeed, Shock Doctrine.
Oh, sorry, Shock Doctrine. Right, an excellent job.
Oh, indeed,
presenting how criminal Friedman. Now Goolsbee, you know, he's working for Obama. He's part of the Chicago School of Economics. The investigative journalist Kelly Ramirez, who is on Free Thought, Free Speech Radio News out of Berkeley, she's done a series of articles on the Obama economic advisors from the Chicago School. So, though, you know, you have people like that, plus you know, Larry Summers. So, of course, you're going to have massive looting on your hands. And this gets back to one point I was making about Obama when we broke, that when Obama went to Columbia University, his mentor there was Zbigniew Brzezinski, who has been an Obama supporter from the beginning. And who is behind Brzezinski? The Rockefeller family and David Rockefeller. Rockefeller, when he set up the Trilateral Commission, he put Brzezinski as the managing director of the Trilateral Commission. So, you know, if you're wondering, you know, why the looting going on and who ultimately...
Oh, indeed, they're going to break away.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
I want to get back to Rockefeller and the trilateralists and Brzezinski, but let me just mention one thing for listeners. Those who checked the week's schedule earlier in the week, please check again. Yesterday, I added a fourth live program on Thursday. Originally had three live programs, two archive repeats. We want to go back and talk about Gaza again because a Virginia-based professor is on this all the time. Gaza is under siege. The heavy conflict ended in January, but it never stopped. The territory is under siege. Egypt right now is blocking. Egypt is blocking desperately needed aid to come through. The international community supports this, and the people are starving to death. Besides being homeless, besides thousands killed and wounded, and so on. And virtually the entire world is criminally complicit in keeping this horrible stuff going. Anyway, there's some new developments, and we'll talk about it on the program Thursday. Sadly, they're not good, which is the reason I wanted to add a program. Well, the trilateralists aren't good either, Francis. You used to be a legal advisor to the PLO way back, so you know what's going on, and you've written books about it and so on, and you've been on in the past, and we've talked about some of the horrible things that have gone on and continue to go on. It doesn't end, but we have to keep fighting back.
It's basically slow-motion genocide that's going on in Gaza right now, and then periodically it becomes accelerated genocide, as we saw the bombing campaign in December and January, the 28 days, where they literally wiped out 1,400 Palestinians, shot them down as if they were dogs in the street. And the embargo still goes on today with the support of the United States and the European Union and Egypt as well. Egypt is on our payroll. They get $3 billion a year. So they do pretty much, Mubarak does pretty much what we tell him to do, and that's to starve the Gazans. Yeah.
It's incredible, Francis. For these people, it's good politics to starve innocent civilians to death. Innocent civilians that pose no threat to anybody, men, women, children, infants, starve them to death. Shoot them down like dogs. That's right.
You have 1.5 million people over there, and they basically live in a garbage dump anyway, because they've been corralled into this starting in the 1948 war and then the 1967 war. Today Israel, I guess, is just celebrating its day of independence, but it was what the Palestinians call their Nakba, the catastrophe. And that's where the Gaza problem originated. I've been over to Gaza. I've been all up and down Gaza repeatedly. And even before this latest situation, it was a humanitarian catastrophe. And now it's simply being accelerated.
Well, I've had guests on the program live from Gaza when the conflict was going on, Francis. And one of them, a Gaza blogger, he's in London now. I'm trying to reach him. The woman I'll have on Thursday, Rachel Rudolph, she was on one of the time. She suggested we get him on. He's, I don't know how he got out of Gaza, but he did, and he's in London now. And both of us have tried to reach him. We haven't reached him yet. If we do, we'll get him on the program as well. But he was contributing a daily commentary living in Gaza during the conflict and just saying what he saw, what he heard, what he knew. And I had him on the program once for about 10 minutes, and then he said he had a window of opportunity, he thought, to go out and try to find some bread, meaning food, some bread for the family. Well, you can't live on bread alone. But the situation was very dire then, and it still is dire now. And these are horrendous war crimes.
Right, I made a proposal for the United Nations General Assembly to set up an international criminal tribunal for Israel along the lines of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia set up by the Security Council. And that proposal is now in circulation at the UN General Assembly. It's been publicly endorsed by the government of Malaysia, and now recently the government of Iran and four or five other Muslim states. So we'll have to see how it goes. I don't know. There's only so much I can do, but at least that idea is out there. UN Human Rights Council has set up a committee under Justice Goldstone to investigate the situation. And then council's also asked its special rapporteur on Palestine, Professor Falk, to make reports on it. He recently made a pretty distressing report on the situation. So you know, there are people working on it. The Arab League also set up a commission to investigate Israeli war crimes there in Gaza. And that was that's under the chairmanship of Professor Dugard from South Africa, who had been the former special rapporteur on Palestine, Professor Falk taking his place. And while he was special rapporteur, Dugard filed several reports saying, this was even before the latest attacks, saying that the apartheid situation for Palestinians in all of occupied Palestine was even worse than apartheid in South Africa when he was opposing apartheid in South Africa while living there at risk to his life. Professor Dugard is a very courageous person. So it's a tough nut to crack, especially when the United States government is fully supporting this. And there has really been no change under the Obama administration from the Bush policies to his policies. I don't see much of a change, just the rhetoric. You know, he did appoint George Mitchell, but I don't, you know, I think that's more a public relations move than anything else. So I really can't say that we can expect much change from Obama. It's really going to be up to the rest of us to produce change. That's why I called for the creation of the Israeli divestment disinvestment campaign that has now taken off on a not just a nationwide but a worldwide basis to take the same approach we took toward apartheid South Africa that did succeed toward Israel, and just start selling off investments and stock and companies that do business with Israel. And it is beginning to have an economic impact on them. It's going to take more time. But as I see it and saw it at the time, for the first time ever, the Palestinians now have a grassroots movement, certainly here in America and around the world, in their support. Certainly in my lifetime here in the United States, going back to the struggle for civil rights for black people, the only progressive change we have seen is grassroots movements. Right now, we're not going to see it coming out of Washington, D.C. So there are things we can do, you know, to help the people in Gaza, but it's going to take time. And in the meantime, they're dying today as we speak.
Oh, absolutely, Francis. Change, you know what I certainly know. A change comes from the grassroots, from the bottom up, and the global BDS movement, boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israel. It really has, it certainly has to go along a lot further than it's gone so far, but it really has been launched, and it has at least a bit of momentum. And I have a lot of hope that this thing will build slowly and really over time have an impact. Let's do something.
Well, in my last book, Breaking All the Rules, I have an appendix in there where I accumulate all the organizations around the world that have so far endorsed and gotten involved in this Israeli divestment, disinvestment campaign. And it goes on for a good 30 to 40 pages. So it really has taken off, and it's, I think, continuing. Now it's accelerating because I think people saw in the latest Israeli extermination campaign against the Palestinians in Gaza what they're really all about. I mean, if you had any doubt of their intentions towards the Palestinians, you'd have to be blind not to see the what one commentator called a satanic fury that Israel unleashed against the basically defenseless population of Gaza. And I think finally that really woke a lot of people up, that it was right there in front of them. They could no longer deny it. It was so ruthless, unprincipled, senseless, callous, inhumane. And because you had Al Jazeera in Gaza, and also Iranian Press TV in Gaza. And you had the internet and bloggers, cell phones and things. We finally could get a picture of what was really going on. You know, you could see the white phosphorus shells exploding over Palestinian cities and the carnage, death, and destruction. So I would hope that that finally opened the minds of a lot of people, and they're now simply accelerating their support for the divestment, disinvestment campaign. But my book did go to press before that, and it has a good 30 pages in there, an appendix of all the organizations that have supported it.
Well, in your newest one, at least I think it is, you turn out so many books, Francis, I can't keep up with you. But the newest one that I have is the one tackling America's toughest questions. I believe you go into the fact that, as so surprised, the Bush administration basically signed off with Israel months in advance to launch this attack on Gaza. I mean, they've done it all the time. The same thing happened in Lebanon in 2006. These things don't just happen. They're planned many months in advance, and Israel would not dare to conduct a major operation like this without the full consent of Washington. And, of course, they get their weapons from Washington. We supply them. We supply them with billions of dollars. And it really was a joint operation between Washington and Israel. Israel did the fighting. We supplied the weapons and the money.
That's correct. There was a massive weapons shipment to Israel to enable this to happen. And then after it happened, there was another massive U.S. Weapons shipment to renew the stockpile of U.S. weapons they have. Finally, this time was so bad that even Amnesty International came out and said that the United States government should suspend any weapon supply to Israel. That received very little publicity, but they did make this this statement. I was on the board of directors with Amnesty International USA when we got the authority to call for a suspension of the sale or provision of U.S. Weapons, equipment, and supplies to foreign governments engaged in massive violations of human rights. And that was about 1992. And it took Amnesty International 17 years, finally, to make this call. But at least they did. I guess you'd have to say better late than never. But what Israel did to Gaza was so horrendous that even Amnesty, which is pretty pro-Israel most of the time, finally came out and called for the suspension of all U.S. military weapons, equipment, and supplies to Israel. And that is their standing position now as we speak.
Oh, indeed, Francis. I quoted what they said about it. And Human Rights Watch, too. Also another group that goes very easy on Israel and very easy on us, but they condemn the use of illegal weapons, specifically white phosphorus. And they were pretty strong in their comments about it. I quoted them as well. And I've come down hard on both Amnesty and Human Rights Watch when they've really just been outrageously bad on the other side by simply attacking the wrong things, like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, attacking Hugo Chavez and just plain lying about him, and then going easy on countries like Israel and the U.S. that really should be really taking the task. Down one side and up the other, with no holes barred, no mincing of words. Both of these countries commit the worst of crimes, and why not? They're joined at the hip. The U.S. is still the wealthiest country in the world, and we just run roughshod any place we want for any reason, and because we're the biggest and the meanest and the richest and the toughest, we have decided that we have a right to do this. Well, sorry, you know the law, Francis, and for you the law is sacred, and me as a non-lawyer, it's sacred for me, too.
Well, yeah, I do have a book on that called Palestine, Palestinians, and International Law that does, you know, go through the whole legal and historical background here to the mandate for Palestine after World War I by the League of Nations and taking it up to date. And then that was supplemented by my last book, Breaking All Rules, that came out a year ago and continued the, you know, I would say sorry saga of what Israel and the United States have done to the Palestinians. And again, with Obama, I think it's just smoke and mirrors. It doesn't appear there's going to be any change in policy coming out of Washington. If there is going to be a change in policy, it has to be by the American people. Again, very much what happened with apartheid in South Africa, where for the most part the presidency and the Congress was in bed with the Afrikaner apartheid regime, and the American people, particularly African Americans, set up the disinvestment campaign, and that was a grassroots movement. I remember when I first moved out here in 1978, there was hardly anyone involved. I think people thought we were all Don Quixotes or something. But eventually it did take off and consummated Federal Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act of 1986, passed over Reagan's veto, that cut off all economic ties between the U.S. and apartheid South Africa. And that was the end of the game. Soon thereafter, Mandela was set free.
We have to do it again. Francis, we need to take a break, and we'll come back for our last segment. We'll be right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. I'm for a final segment with Francis Boyle. Francis, I want to say a little bit more about your newest book. And I've got it in my hand, Tackling America's Toughest Questions, Alternative Media Interviews. And on the back of the book, oh, I just did something. What did I do to my, oh, there it is. I did something strange to my desktop where everything seemed to change, but I've got it back looking the way I want it to look now. Computers do baffle me at times, but you go into so much in this book, from the war on terrorism to the nonsensical notion of unlawful enemy combatants, Guantanamo, kangaroo courts, torture, extraordinary renditions, two illegal wars, the war crimes committed there, possible more conflicts against Iran and Syria, really may have happened on those anthrax attacks against Congress. Things aren't always as they seem. There's always something behind them. Certainly 9/11 as well. And the Bush administration green-lighting the Gaza attack, Georgia's attack against South Ossetia last August, spying, so much in a country that calls itself a democracy. We hold ourselves up, Francis, as a model to the world. My goodness, some kind of model. Not one I want to emulate.
The problem, of course, is the torture scandal really, I'm afraid, unmasked what we're all about to the rest of the world. Thanks to these Federalist Society and neoconservative lawyers in the Bush administration, one of whom Kagan hired for Harvard Law School, this guy Goldsmith. I would have to say, sadly, about 1.25 Muslims in the world, billion Muslims in the world, think the United States is pretty much a nation of sadists and sexual perverts. And more of these pictures are going to be coming out. And that, I think, is the terrible tragedy of all of this. It's hard to deny what we're all about in light of the Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo torture scandals and pictures. And now we see, if you sort of glance through the mainstream news media, the pundits and things of that nature, they're still out there defending it or saying that, well, the picture shouldn't come out. It's against national security and things of this nature. It seems to me that if we are ever possibly going to restore our image, we will have to prosecute the Bush administration officials involved in the torture matter. This is required a prosecution under the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture. And there's simply no way that the Obama administration can get out of that. Now, it does appear they are doing their best to weasel out of it. I think we, the American people, have to keep pressure on the administration, on the president, on the attorney general, on Congress, to insist on prosecution from President Bush, Vice President Cheney on down, and especially the lawyers who authored these memoranda that gave the green light to the CIA and the Pentagon.
Oh, indeed, Francis.
To engage in the torture.
That music means they're going to break away to the next program, but all I have to do is to say, number one, a big amen to everything you just said, as well as all your other comments during the hour. You have to come back so we can continue this. So important, and about all I have time left to do is to thank you again for coming on.
Well, thanks again, Stephen, and please keep up the good work getting an alternative message out there to the American people.
Oh, indeed, Francis, we just have to keep at this. It's the way you win. You just don't ever quit. You don't quit.